Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Good morning. It's great to be back here at the Mermaid. As Andy said, my name's Joel. I attend the East Service. I spent many years at the Mermaid coming to church here, so it's great to be back. I see you now have pastries as well, which is I'm slightly jealous about, but seem to have gone up in the world since we left, which says a lot about us, I think. It's also great to see you here, and I know that the leaders at Christchurch wouldn't say that preaching on the August bank holiday is the graveyard shift, but the reason why many people away isn't because I'm speaking, so I'm told. It is because they're off and gallivanting wherever they are. And as Addy said, we are about halfway through our sermon series, looking at the book 1 John called The Summer of Love, which is a lovely title. And we think that community really matters here at Christchurch, and that we grow best when we're surrounded by people who are who love us and who are committed to our well-being. And John's first letter is all about how God's love transforms us into being the kind of people who are able to love him and love one another. And firstly, if you've not heard any of the talks in this series, here's some context. The book of 1 John was unsurprisingly written by a man called John, one of Jesus' disciples, the same author as the Gospel of John, 2 John, and 3 John. And they were seemingly less imaginative with their book titles in ancient times. And 1 John is a letter written to a group of young churches who, in a lot of ways, were still trying to figure out what it meant to be a follower of Jesus, which sounds awfully familiar to me. And as a result, they were finding that they were being easily influenced by teaching that did not come from God. And the primary influence that came was what is called Gnosticism. And you may have heard of the Gnostic Gospels, and Joseph talked about this in more detail last week. And the Gnostics essentially believed that the material world was evil and the spiritual world was good. They believed that the ultimate supreme God did not create the earth, but a lesser God who messed it up and created a world full of suffering, death, decay, and Manchester United. And the result of that, too many Man United fans in here, and the result of that teaching brought two responses. One was that we should shun the world and its brokenness and focus purely on what is spiritual or higher. And then the other response was that because they didn't think the material world mattered very much, they could do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted in the material world. And so for the churches at that time, confusion and uncertainty would have been the order of the day. Should they focus purely on the spiritual world? Should they really not care about what they did in the material world? Were there really no consequences for their actions? And if you were to read the whole of 1 John, one of the things you'd notice is what John calls the people he's writing to. He refers to them as children, and he does this a total of nine times in the whole of 1 John. Nowhere else does he do this. He doesn't do this in the Gospel of John, in 2 John, in 3 John, or in the Return of the John. That's not an actual book, that's a joke. And if I was to come up here and greet you all as children, or little children, as John often does in this book, I think you'd probably be a little bit offended. I think you'd take it the wrong way. And even if Ross, who has far more authority than I have, came up here and called you all little children, I think you'd still be offended, even though Ross is kind of the right age to do that. Sorry, Ross. So why does John do that here? Firstly, I think he's using it as a term of affection. And the readers of this letter would have known that John was writing to them from a place of fatherly love. And secondly, I think it reinforces John's authority to be able to teach them the way that is good. And the people reading this letter would have been hearing all sorts of teaching that differed from what John had taught them in the past. And so by referring to them as his children, John is communicating that not only does this message come from a place of love, but also from a place of authority. And this probably says more about me than it does about John, but I also wonder if there's a bit of sassiness in John as well. He wants to make clear that he's the daddy and you need to do exactly what I tell you. But when you do think about it, of all the people the people in the who were receiving this letter, of all the people they should have been listening to, John was the man. He'd known Jesus. He talked with Jesus. He hugged Jesus. He ate with Jesus. And he is someone who had first-hand knowledge of the things that Jesus taught. And in fact, in the first verse of 1 John, he reminds them of this. He says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at, and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. These churches would have known they could trust John because John had been with Jesus from the start. And I also think there's another interesting dynamic when you put yourself in the mindset of a child. If these readers are hearing nine times being called children, I'm sure their mindset would have been slightly different to if John wasn't doing this. And Michael D. Robinson, who's a psychologist from the University of Dakota, he conducted an experiment where he randomly split a few hundred students into two groups. And the first group, he gave the following instructions. You have the entire day to yourself. What would you do? Where would you go? And if someone asked me that question, it would probably involve an overpriced flat white, overpriced brunch, maybe a market or two, and then sit in a coffee shop pretending to read a book. That would probably be my day. Some of you thinking, that's what I did yesterday. That's a bit, how does he know? And then to the second group, he said this. You're 7 years old and school is cancelled. What would you do? Where would you go? And this is probably what seven-year-old Joel would be doing. Fighting crime. Still fits. It's not funny. And after writing for about 10 minutes, the students from both groups were given various tests of creativity. And the group that had imagined themselves as young children scored far higher, coming up with twice as many results as the group before. So if you can restore some of your creativity when you put yourself in the mindset of a child, I wonder what it can do for us spiritually. Perhaps we remove some of the obstacles that we put in front of ourselves or maybe in front of God. Or perhaps our hearts become a little bit softer and we put ourselves in the position where we can be shaped and molded. Which is convenient because if being like children not only helps us to be shaped, it is also at the core of our identity. And we will look at this in a lot more detail later on. So without further ado, let's read the passage. And we'll be reading from chapter 2, verse 28, and the words should be up on the screen behind me. And now, dear children, continue in him so that when he appears, we may be confident and unashamed before him at his coming. If you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone who does not what is right has been born of him. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. Everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that he appeared so that he might take away our sins, and in him is no sin. No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. Dear children, do not let anyone lead you astray. The one who does what is right is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. No one who is born of God will continue to sin, because God's seed remains in them. They cannot go on sinning, because they have been born of God. This is how we know who the children of God are and who the children of the devil are. Anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor is anyone who does not love their brother and sister. And this passage, like a lot of this letter, covers a lot of topics and can provoke all sorts of emotions and perhaps uses language and ideas that are difficult to digest. But I think the overriding theme from this passage is that God's love transforms us, both in our identity and our behavior, and becomes a model for how we are to live and love each other. And today I'll be exploring what it means to be a child of God, how it leads us to action, and how we can love and serve our community better as a result. All of my life, people have made comparisons with me to my dad, David. And I never really got out of the slightly adolescent phase of saying, shut up, no I'm not, stupid. I thought I was far better looking, far cooler, and a lot funnier than my dad. And if you know my dad, you'll know that is that's true. But my resemblance to my dad really hit home when one of my sisters showed this picture to a friend of ours and asked him who he thought it was. And with a complete straight face, he said, well, that's Joel. Now, that's not me. That's my dad. And my reaction to this was, surely not. He must be joking. My jaw is far more chiseled than that. She asked again, and this time confusion reaches our friend's face, and he says, well, that's Joel, right? Now, I can't see it whatsoever, but my friend could. And that picture is about 50 years old as well, so I'm slightly offended as to how old he thinks I am, but that's a separate issue. But we all carry a glimpse of where we come from, our family history. And there's something pretty remarkable that not only do we carry our kind of character traits of our family, but we visibly carry our heritage around with us as well. And I also have the unfortunate Wade big head gene too. And at school, they called me Joel Wide, which was deeply embarrassing. Don't call me that. But perhaps one of the most important aspects of the Christian message is that when we become a follower of Jesus, we're not only saved from falling short of the standard that God sets us, but we're also reborn into a new family, into God's family, and we're called children of God. We're given a new identity. And it's one of those things that we can hear so often in church, but often we can lose or forget the significance of what it actually means. And I love John's excitement in chapter 3, verse 1. He says, "See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are." It's almost like he can't believe it. And when we call children of God, it's not just a status. As God's children, it changes our very being, our very identity. We are reborn or born again into a new family. And John calls the people to put aside who they once were and become the people they were reborn to be. And this is so important, this is crucial, because just in the same way that my identity as a Wade is physically written in my face or on the shape of my head, our identity always influences how we act, think, and behave. You may have heard of the Stanford Prison Experiment, run by a famous psychologist called Philip Zimbardo, who's been quoted at Christchurch before. And the experiment was in 1973. And the aim was to investigate how readily people would conform to the roles of guard and prisoner in a role-playing exercise that simulated prison life. And Zimbardo was primarily interested in finding out whether some of the brutality reported amongst guards in American prisons was due to the sadistic personalities of the guards or whether it had more to do with the prison environment itself. And so Zimbardo converted a basement in Stanford University into a mock prison and advertised to students the opportunity to play the role of prisoner or guard for 2 weeks. He received more than 70 applications, and all the chosen candidates were given interviews and personality tests to eliminate anyone who might have psychological difficulties or anyone with a history of crime that could skew the results. And the chosen participants were randomly assigned the role of prisoner or guard. And within hours of being assigned roles, what happened was remarkable. The guards began to harass the prisoners. They began to behave more and more brutal, while the prisoners began to adopt prison-like behavior too. They took the rules extremely seriously, despite the simulated environment and the poor treatment they received from their guards or their fellow students. And as the prisoners became more and more submissive, the guards became more and more aggressive. And one prisoner even had to be released early after he had uncontrollable bursts of crying, anger, and screaming. And then three more were released early as well, as they began to show emotional or signs of emotional disorder that could have long-lasting effects. But what I found most fascinating about this study was the behavior of Zimbardo himself. And this guy is a world-famous psychologist. He's a professor at Stanford University, so he's a very smart man. And during the experiment, he took on the role of superintendent of the prison. And Zimbardo had heard a rumor that one of the released prisoners, prisoner 8612, was going to come back, start a riot, and release the prisoners that were still there. And here's what happened to them.
A rumor circulated that released prisoner 8612 would return to France to liberate the remaining prisoners.
I quickly convinced myself that, you know, my most important function was, you know, not to allow this prison liberation to occur. And what can I do to keep the prison going, not the experiment going?
The prison was dismantled and the prisoners moved to another part of the building. Zimbardo waited in the empty corridor, preparing to tell 8612 and his friends that the study was over, when a colleague appeared and began asking questions about the scientific basis of the research.
I'm trying to get rid of him, and then he says, what's the independent variable? I get curious, because if he understand that there's a riot about to take place, that this prison is about to erupt. And I totally lost this whole other identity of scientist, researcher, psychologist.
The experiment was closed after just 6 days when Zimbardo's girlfriend visited the prison and saw with fresh eyes just how out of hand the experiment had gotten. And in 2008, Zimbardo reflected on his own behavior. He said, "It wasn't until much later that I realized how far into my prison role I was at that point, that I was thinking like a prison superintendent rather than a research psychologist." And what was made so dangerously obvious in this experiment, and I believe what John is writing in this letter, is that identity shapes behavior. In fact, whenever the Bible talks about a new identity or a rebirth or being born again, the sign of that rebirth is new behavior. And the Bible often refers to this as fruit. And this can be both a comfort and a challenge to us. And I think for a lot of us, we can call ourselves Christian, but we don't necessarily see our identity as children of God. And we often draw our identity from other things. Perhaps we strive to have the best possible career we can have. We have our identity in our career and we push our relationships further and further away. Or maybe we get our identity from our relationships and when they break down, we are destroyed. Or maybe we draw our identity from the fact that we've got no problems, we are completely sorted, so we push our pain further and further or deeper and deeper down, so we can keep up the facade. And so often we can draw our identity from the mistakes that we've made in our past. But when you get to the point where you can say that you're a follower of Jesus, but you keep drawing your identity from things other than God or from the mistakes you've made in your past, what kind of behavior is that going to create? And I remember listening to a podcast a few years ago that had a massive impact for me in this area. And in hindsight, it's really simple. He said that if you were to see yourself as holy, if you saw holiness as part of your identity, what would that change? And this brought up loads of questions for me, and eventually it kind of turned around my mindset. And at that point, I'd been a Christian for a long time, but if someone was to suggest to me that holiness was part of my identity, I'd probably say, no, 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 I'm not holy, I'm a sinner. I'm the reverse. But this speaker said that if you identify as a sinner, and that's how you see yourself, chances are you're going to sin, because identity shapes behavior. And when I messed up, when I made a mistake, because I saw myself as a sinner, that was my identity, I'd carry this defeatist mindset that, well, of course I'm going to sin. I'm a sinner. That's what sinners do. But when I thought, I realized that, yes, of course I sin, but my identity isn't as a sinner anymore. I'm a child of God. So when I make mistakes, my thoughts change from I'm a sinner, woe is me, to this is not who I am. I'm a child of God, and children of God are supposed to pursue holiness. And one of my favorite verses in the Bible sums this up really well. It's Romans 5, verse 8, and it says, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us." And the key word for me at that point was "were." While we were still sinners. Yes, we still make mistakes, but our identity is no longer a sinner. We're children of God. Did you know that? Does that change how you see yourself? And if Zimbardo's experiment told us anything, it's that we need to know who we are so that our behavior is a reflection of that. Identity shapes behavior. So if our identity is that we're children of God, what is our expected behavior? Or what behavior will that produce in us? And in this passage, John gives us the answer multiple times. In 3 verse 3, he says, "All who have this hope, identity in him, purify themselves just as he is pure," behavior. In verse 6, "No one who lives in him," identity, "keeps on sinning," behavior. And in verse 9, "No one who is born of God," identity, "will continue to sin." And put simply, the mark of a child of God is the pursuit of holiness. And this is where we get to one of the trickier parts of this passage, and it confused me a lot when I was studying and when I first read it. Verse 6 says this, "No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him." And in verse 9, "No one who is born of God will continue to sin because God's seed remains in them. They cannot go on sinning because they have been born of God." So when we read verses about how the children of God do not sin, It can often lead to a misunderstood explanation of what is being said, and people can either fall into pride or plunge into despair. And even though these sound like polar opposites, they are rooted in the same misunderstanding. They are based on the assumption that what John is saying is that the sign of a true Christian, of a genuine child of God, is that we never, ever sin. And you only have to spend 5 minutes with Andy Tilsley to know that's categorically not true. That was a good one, I thought. So some people might read these verses and think, great, I'm a good person. I don't sin, therefore I must be a Christian. But the problem with that is that it's blatantly self-delusional. Essentially, it's a misunderstanding, firstly, of what sin is, and secondly, how serious God sees it. It's so serious that Jesus came to die for us so that we can be free from it. And another problem with that outlook is that it can only breed hypocrisy, because if us as the church and as Christians said that because we're now Christians, we can do no wrong, we'll be complete hypocrites, because we will. We'll mess up. We'll make mistakes. But then others might read these verses and react slightly differently. They might be absolutely terrified, thinking they're Christians, but having a profound sense of their own failure, of their own sin. And then read these verses and think, well, maybe I was never a Christian after all. But in a previous chapter of this very letter, John has already made clear that Christians can and do sin. In 1 John 1, 8 to 10, it says, "If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just, and will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. If we claim we have not sinned, we make him out to be a liar, and his word is not in us." So we have chapter 1 saying that if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. And in chapter 3 saying, or we read, that if we sin, we don't know Jesus. So what is going on? Is this a mistake? Is this a contradiction? And there are a few different ways we can interpret these passages in chapter 3. The first is saying that rather than the children of God don't sin, it's saying the children of God don't make a habit of sinning. And the use of the present tense keeps on suggests that it's the habitual sin that Christians don't do, but the odd occasional sin will squeeze in there. And I think there's probably some truth in that, but I do know from my own experience and the experience of others that often when we sin, at its root is the same problem. Maybe pride or lust or greed. And another interpretation of this is what John is describing here is the ideal Christian, or what the ideal situation would be for every Christian. And essentially he's giving us the standard for what we should do and how we should live. And for what it's worth, there's some truth in both of those. I think they're both partly right. But I think what John is doing here is that he's using language to describe a disposition, particularly as the Greek word that is translated, he cannot, doesn't necessarily mean the complete incapacity for doing something. And I think John, like Jesus does on so many occasions, is using hyperbole to make a point. He's exaggerating to make his point. And we do this kind of thing all the time. And perhaps the best example I could think of was what it takes to be a true Londoner. And the classic example is that Londoners don't speak on the tube or make eye contact unless there's a dog or a baby involved. You might be able to relate to that. And there's countless other examples on BuzzFeed and things like that. And here's some of my favorites. Number one, Londoners only understand foreign cities by comparing their neighborhoods to different areas of London. Oh, so it's the Dalston of Barcelona. Oh, it's the Soho of Stockholm. Lovely. Literally said those very words in the last 3 months. It was very embarrassing. Number two, Londoners would rather walk through Mordor than walk through Leicester Square on a Saturday night. That's definitely true. Number three, Londoners are suspicious of acts of kindness. Maybe. And number four, Londoners never stare at people who are drawing too much attention to themselves, which is why no one talks to Andy very much. That's number two. Sorry, man. Everyone else is away. And I got married a few months ago, and one of the things I didn't realise when you get married is that husbands aren't allowed to drink beer or go out without the permission from their wives first. That was news to me. Don't know if any husbands can relate to that. Maybe I would have reconsidered. But Londoners, that's a joke, but Londoners don't talk on the tube, husbands don't drink beer, and the children of God don't sin. John is using hyperbole to make a point. He's exaggerating to make a point. And if Jesus' purpose was to remove sin, and to be a child of God is recognizing that fact, it would be a contradiction if the children of God actively sought to keep on sinning. And it's why we should all now strive for holiness. And ultimately, what John is saying is what you do on the outside is a reflection of who you are on the inside. And if we really are children of God, some of our father's traits or our family traits will rub off on us. And this doesn't mean that we don't daily have to fight against sin or that we're completely free from temptation. In fact, it's the opposite. When you become a child of God, you now recognize that they exist in your life. You fight them because you now see them. And not only is this a picture of how we should be, but also why Jesus had to come. Children of God don't sin, but we do. Which is why Jesus' death not only covers the sin of my past, but the sin of my future as well. Identity shapes behavior. And before we move on, it would be wrong of me not to tackle one of the harder verses in this passage. And perhaps the most difficult to read is this, or maybe even offensive to hear, is this idea of being a child of God or a child of the devil. And that's pretty hard stuff to read, but I want to make sure, make clear what this means. It does not mean that if you are not a Christian, you have made a decision to follow the devil. I mean, many of you may not even believe in the idea of a God or the devil, so how can you make that decision? And the Gospel of John actually helps us with this verse. Jesus says in the Gospel of John, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." And what Jesus is saying, which is confirmed in 1 John, is that you become a child of God. You are not born a child of God. You are reborn, or famously, you are born again. So the question is, what are we reborn from? Or to put it another way, what are we born into? And Romans 5 helps us with this. It says that sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. We are all born into a fallen world as fallen people. We are not born into God's family. There is no second birth into the family of sin because we were already there. That's our default state. And what John is saying in this passage is that before we are reborn, we're still part, before we're reborn into God's family, we're still part of this fallen world. And that is precisely why Jesus came, to set us free from that. And he took us from a place of complete despair and brought us into his family, and that is where we now have hope. So identity shapes behavior, and ultimately this leads to two things. And the first is love, and this is the summer of love after all, so it had to be a point. Loving each other is living evidence that we are born of God, that we are his children, and that we share his nature. In verse 10 it says this, "Anyone who does not do what is right is not God's child, nor is anyone who does not love their brother and sister." And this verse, or these verses, not only emphasize the importance of doing what is right, or in other words, holiness, or seeking holiness, but also of love. Holiness and love are the mark of the children of God. And my prayer is that just in the same way people will know I'm David's son by just by looking at me and my slightly oversized head, I pray that people will know that there's something different about us as a church because of how we act and how we love. And this is so important because holiness without love is dangerous. And it's what Jesus warned against so often in the Gospels, particularly to religious leaders. And I work in digital design, so I design apps and websites, spending hours kind of perfecting a design, working with developers to try and come up with nice transitions and fancy fades and beautiful typography and all that kind of stuff. But as is the case in so many projects, money dictates everything. And usually the business wants to release the thing you've designed as quickly and as cheaply as possible. And often, the thing that gets cut first is the beauty of a design. So the final product that gets built works fine, it works in the right way, but it loses all of the beauty that the designer originally intended, and it becomes a shell of what it was intended or supposed to be. And it's a bit like that with holiness without love. We might work in the right way, but if we do not have love, we are not living the way we were designed to live. So in whatever we do, how we interact with others, if we do not have love, we are not bearing the fruit or the evidence that our identity has changed and that we're now children of God. And what we've seen from this series, and we'll continue to see, is just how important John sees love and community. God's love transforms us so that we love him and love one another. And I want us as a church to be a place where we are known for the love we have for each other, but also for the love we have for those not yet part of us. Because it's easy to love our friends, most of our friends. But how are you doing at loving others not yet part of our community? How are we doing at bringing others into our family? Are we happy with our friends and not really have any time for anyone else? And I remember the moment where I felt like Christchurch was my home. It was strangely when I stopped expecting to be welcomed. Whether that was because I had my friends or my connect group, but I remember that for a long time, I would sit on my own waiting for someone to say hi to me. And then when people did and brought me into their world, into their lives, it was then up to me to do the same to others. How are we doing at that? Identity shapes behavior, which leads to love. And secondly, this new identity and behavior leads to new hope, or a new hope if you are a Star Wars fan. And this is one of the things that's really gripped me about this passage. The children of God have a hope that what is to come is better than what has been. And that if we abide in him, as John says, we may have confidence and not shrink from him in shame at his coming. And one day we will see Jesus face to face as he is. Beloved, John says, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. And I can't even comprehend what that would be like. And I don't think John could either. But whatever it will be, I know that the things I've been talking about today are leading me or preparing me for that moment. And for those of us who have this hope, purify themselves, or in other words, pursue holiness. And I think John Stott, who was a hugely influential writer and leader of All Souls in Langham Place near Oxford Street, he sums this up really, really well. He said, the fact of his, Jesus, first appearing and the hope of his second are both strong incentives to holiness. Not only does being reborn as a child of God lead us towards holiness, but the hope that one day we will meet him face to face. And at its core, it means that what is to come is better than what has been. And one day this world full of pain, suffering and hurt, but also love and beauty, will be renewed into something better. And that is the hope that we have. And there have been times in my life where I have been profoundly grateful for that hope. And it sounds simple, but this hope that what is to come is better than what has been is something I've often come back to, particularly in difficult times. And if you feel like you have no hope, I'd really encourage you to speak with someone after, maybe the prayer team at the end. Because this hope I've been talking about is open to all of us. It is open to you through Jesus. Maybe the band want to come up. During our wedding, the whole day, I'd managed to keep it together. I thought I'd be a crying wreck the moment I saw my niece and nephew walk down the aisle, let alone seeing Dee. But the moment I wasn't able to keep the tears back was when I was thanking my parents during my speech. And the main reason being is that I kind of felt like this was the only opportunity publicly I'd have just to say how much they meant to me and how blessed I am that I'm their son. And what made it even more emotional is that, and this might surprise you, I'd never really told them how I felt before. I kept it in. So when I was giving my speech, I could barely speak as this overwhelming sense of love and gratitude came over me. And if that is the reaction I have, the fact that I'm away, even with my big head gene and all, how much more amazing is it that we get to be part of God's family? How incredible is that? That we have a God who saves us from a place of complete hopelessness to a place of hope, and it cost him everything to do that. You may be a Christian, but you may not see your identity as a child of God, but as a sinner, as not good enough, as unlovable. I just want to challenge you on that. You are a child of God. That is how God sees you. And I want to leave you with this simple question. If you saw yourself as a child of God, if you saw yourself as holy, what would that change? Would that change in identity change your behavior? Would it change how you dealt, or your mindset? Would it change how you dealt with temptation and sin? And you may be exploring faith, but whatever stage you're at in your journey, the opportunity to be a child of God is open to every one of us. And Jesus didn't come to be the most influential leader or have the most successful career or make a load of money. He came to serve, he came to love, and he came to lay down his life so you could be part of his family. I'm going to pray, and then the band, if you could play. Yeah, God, thank you so much that our identity is in you, Lord, that our identity is that we are children of God. Thank you for just the amazing reality that is, Lord. I pray that for each and every one of us, we would just really know that at our core, that our identity is children of God, and we would get some of the excitement that John has for this fact, Lord. And for those of us who don't recognize that, Lord, I just pray that this hope that I've been talking about will just resonate, and that people will kind of see who you are, what you've done for us, and how much you love us, Lord. Amen.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.